Welcome back to the program. Throughout most of the 20th century, General Motors represented the pinnacle of the American economy. It was an economy built on manufacturing, and General Motors was the tallest smokestack. Today, GM, as well as our manufacturing-based economy, is in tatters, and we're told we're in a brain-powered, knowledge-based, information-driven economy. And the company that stands the tallest today in this new economy is Google. Founded by two idealistic young engineers, its goal is nothing short of organizing all of the information in the world. How well has it succeeded? Is it vulnerable? Will hubris lead to its downfall? And how has it really changed the world? We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Ken Auletta. He's one of the most astute and trusted media journalists and critics writing today. He's written the Annals of Communication column for The New Yorker since 1992. He is the author of 8 previous books, including 3 Blind Mice, Greed and Glory on Wall Street, and World War 3.0. It is my pleasure to have Ken Auletta here today to talk about his newest work, Google, The End of the World as We Know It. Ken Auletta, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. One of the things, we look at Google, we often think of it as a technology company sitting there in Silicon Valley. The fact of the matter is that this is the largest media company that exists today.
Oh, it's market cap, meaning the value of its stock is over $170 billion, which is 3 times what the largest media company's stock is. And so it's an enormously powerful company. They stopped calling themselves a search company a couple of years ago. They now call themselves a media company. And Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, said to me, which I quote him in the book, is saying, we expect one day to be the first $100 billion, meaning $100 billion in revenue, not market capitalization, but in revenue, media company.
What's remarkable about Google is all the areas it touches. Certainly all the conversations that we have about the decline of the newspaper business, television changing as a result of YouTube, the book business changing as a result of what Google is doing, phones, advertising, all of it touches Google.
It does. One of the reasons why I subtitled my book, The End of the World as We Know It, it's not just because Google changes our life. I mean, it used to be that the Internet made information available, but you couldn't get it. What Google did was make information accessible. So it's changed all of our lives. But it's more important, or more relevant to this discussion, it's changed the lives of traditional media companies. And their world is over. And the digital world is taking over, and they either figure out how to adjust their business to become more digital and how to make money on the Internet, or they will die.
Is it a mistake when we think about Google, particularly as it relates to other aspects of the media business, we tend to want to think of it in kind of a binary way? Are they about distribution, or are they about content? But they seem to bridge that gap in a kind of unique way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's happened, first of all, the Internet is the most efficient distribution system the world has ever invented, A. B, what the Internet does and what the digital world does, it changes our definition of content. For instance, if I'm spending my time doing Google searches, that means I'm not watching CBS or ABC or listening to music or being on the telephone. So is that content if I'm doing search? If I'm on Facebook for 2 hours, is that content? It certainly means that if I'm on Facebook for 2 hours, I'm not watching television or watching a movie. And so in that sense, it is content because it's occupying my eyeballs or my ears. And so the definition of content changes. And one of the things I discovered in the 2.5 years I spent reporting and writing this book is when you go out to Google, half of the employees are engineers. And those engineers are pampered and treated like kings because Google understands something. Those engineers are their content creators. They are the Martin Scorsese's in the Hollywood sense. They are creating content. Google Maps, Google Earth, Google Search, Google News, that's all content to them, and the engineers create it.
The other aspect of what the engineers do that you write about in the book is the idea that they're not necessarily they don't see themselves as eliminating traditional media. They see themselves as creating efficiencies.
Yes. The attitude of the two founders, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, when they enter, is they start from an assumption that the old ways of doing things are inefficient. And in many ways, that's absolutely true. If you think about a newspaper, my God, you're killing trees, You're turning them, expensively turning it into paper. You're buying expensive printing presses, and then you're having a very extensive and expensive distribution system of trucks that belch out a lot of pollution. How much more efficient and cheaper is it to do online? Much. So they start from that attitude, but an engineer starts from a question. And the question is, why? And why not is really what it leads to. Why not be in the advertising business and do it more cheaply and only charge people when they actually click on an ad as opposed to when they spend $3 million for a Super Bowl 30-second spot? Well, why not have inexpensive phone calls on your mobile devices using the Internet? Or why not distribute Google News so you can read any magazine or newspaper in the world for free? So as they do that, inevitably they bump into traditional media, who feels that their business is being disrupted. It is. The consumer is getting something out of it, but the existing business is being harmed by it.
But in order for all that to have happened, there had to be, and there has been, a larger cultural shift. Part of it's generational, part of it goes to other cultural changes, that allows the public to accept these different ways, these more efficient ways of getting information.
It does, and for the public, that is a wondrous thing. I mean, when I do a book, and I could sit here, and I basically, Google provides me with a library at my fingertips, the world's best library at my fingertips. That's fabulous, and it's very efficient of my time. The question becomes, if I can access any news, for instance, any newspaper in the world on Google News, which I can, and I could read it, and if more people do that as I do it, and they stop buying newspapers, then what happens? What happens to, are you still going to have report? It's expensive to have reporters in state capitals and city halls, and to take 2, 3, 4 weeks, sometimes months, on an investigative story that's very important to the democracy, but is also very expensive to produce. And an individual blogger may not be able to do that. It takes resources to do that. So as newspapers shrink and contract, are we as citizens who are enjoying Google News today or Google Search today, are we going to be harmed by that in the long run? And that's a basic question. Can journalism, good journalism as we want it to be, survive?
But as Google didn't exist 10 years ago, we operate on this assumption today, or at least some of us do, that the business model of journalism for the future has yet to emerge, that somehow from this creative destruction will emerge a new model.
That's the hope, and it's not yet the reality. And you know, one of the arguments that Google makes is that isn't it wonderful when we do a search that if they're looking, they'll see three lines about Pakistan today, and you go to the search, and at the bottom there'll be a link, and it'll say linking to the New York Times. Well, it sends you to the New York Times, and which increases the New York Times readership, and also allows the New York Times to sell an ad off of that if they can. The problem is that if more people do that and fewer go to the New York, and the readership of the New York Times goes down, A, and B, the New York Times can only sell that ad for online for one-tenth of what they can sell that ad for in print, which is the general ratio for all newspapers, only 10% of the ad dollars that you get online as you get from print. Then even if you have a larger audience, but the economics may not work out for you, so you're dead. And that's one of the challenges. It is great that the New York Times has a broader readership, but it's not great if it means your readership declines so that it's not compensated.
And to what extent do the engineers and Sergey and Larry and Eric Schmidt, to what extent do all of these people look at the totality of what we're talking about, the broader consequences of what Google does?
I think they've begun to think more about it than they did initially. I mean, for instance, when Larry and came up with the idea of digitizing all the world's books in 2002, the CEO, Eric Schmidt, comes in and he says, well, how are you going to do that? He says, you're just Larry. How are you going to do that? And he said, well, I'll go to my alma mater, the University of Michigan. I'll ask them to let me digitize their books. And then they say, well, we can go to Al Gore, the former vice president, and get him to talk to the Library of Congress, et cetera. So they talked to libraries, but who they didn't talk to with any extensive talk are the publishers and the authors who own the copyrights. So an engineer doesn't necessarily, as this case proves, have the breadth to understand how the world really works. And so then they got into it. What happened was that the Publishers and the Authors Guild filed a lawsuit against Google for copyright infringement, which they subsequently settled in 2006. But nevertheless, they have a number of other lawsuits pending, in part because they're constantly trying to push the envelope and of copyright, of privacy, of you know, just basically saying we want to be able to do this. And some of what they do is absolutely wondrous, but it does intrude on other people who have certain rights, too, and right. It gets messy.
Right, and as that whole intellectual property issue continues to go on, you also have people out there arguing for free content, for books to be written and put up free.
Yeah, I mean, I tell the story in the book, right. When Sergey Brin comes in the office, this is after our second interview, he rollerblades in his T-shirt, he drops his knapsack down on the table. He says, Ken, let me ask you a question. He said, why don't you just publish your book for free on the Internet? You'll have many more readers than you would by knocking down and killing dead trees. I said, well, you might have more readers on the Internet, but Sergey, let me ask you a couple of questions. Who would pay me an advance so that, I mean, I'm on a leave from the New Yorker, the only income I have coming in is an advance on this book. Who would pay me that advance if I published it for free? I said, secondly, who would edit the book? Who would market the book? Who would do my index? You know, who would legally vet it? I mean, all the things that publishers do. And, of course, at that point, he wanted to change the subject. But what the story illustrates is there's a certain naivete about the world that these guys have. They're engineers. And they're being forced to learn very quickly that the world has other interests, and they have to respond to them.
I want to talk about the engineering aspect, because there is a certain, you write about it, with a certain innocence that they're engineers and that they're trying to pull out these greater efficiencies and do interesting things. But there also is a business component of this. I mean, you talked about it in terms of Eric Schmidt talking about what he wants the company to grow to in terms of revenue. They may not be as cold and calculating, as you've said, as Bill Gates, but certainly these are not shrinking violets in the business world.
Oh, no, no. I asked Larry Page, the co-founder of Google, at one point. I said, is it inevitable that you will sometimes bump into traditional media at Google? And he said, not sometimes, always. He knows that. I mean, he's very clear-eyed about that. On the other hand, they're concerned. I mean, if the New York Times dies, if the Wall Street Journal dies, the Washington Post dies, the quality of the information that a Google search does is diminished. It's not as good. So one of the things they talked to me about, at one point, they discussed the possibility of trying to buy the New York Times in order to assure good quality journalism, and that would you know, motor their searches. They decided not to do it because Google should not be in the content business and should not favor one content over another. They should be a neutral Switzerland, and so the decision was not to even talk to the Times about it. But they talked about it. They are concerned about journalism. Larry Page had a long conversation with me about the importance of preserving journalism. The question is, how do they do it? And how much are they willing to give up money to do it? And will it work? And who do you do it? If you do it for the Times, do you do it for which other papers do you do it for?
Right.
And which don't you do it for?
And of course, whatever they do and whatever business model emerges, if they buy content or buy the New York Times or whatever they might buy in the future, there's also the reality of regulators out there looking at it from a traditional media point of view and not necessarily dealing with it from a future perspective.
That is absolutely right. That's one of the issues. I mean, Prince, we saw this in the Microsoft trial. I mean, where the Justice Department and the Clinton administration recommended that Microsoft should be broken up, and the first judge said that Microsoft should be broken up. That was his ruling. That part of the ruling was later overturned. But I always thought that was a crazy recommendation. The market was going to take care of Microsoft, and new technologies like Google was
right.
Diminish Microsoft. You didn't have to go through social engineering to do it in government. But you got other issues that are always going to be relevant and don't involve social engineering. Privacy, for instance. Google collects an enormous amount of data on each of us. Every time we do a search, there's a cookie that is clipping and knowing what we've done, what we search for, how much time we spent on it, what we read on news sites, what we purchase, what ads we click on. They know that that's data that's very valuable to an advertiser. And people, particularly, by the way, more so in Europe, in the European Union than in the U.S., they're very concerned about privacy issues. So the government, it, not just here but elsewhere, are raising questions about privacy. They're raising questions about copyright. And they're raising questions about concentration of power. And those are three issues that, that hang over at Google, and Google has to address.
I mean, you see them responding almost on a daily basis. This story, what, this week about Google Dashboard,
right,
where you can find, you get some sense of the information they have on you.
Right. No, they've been... See, engineers didn't think about the privacy issues for a long period of time. And, but as government begins to ask questions, and basically government is a bear you don't want to get into a war with, and so they're compelled to really listen, because if they don't, they're going to get smacked down. And as they listen, they realize they have to give their users more options and give the government more assurances about how they're going to protect privacy.
The other side of it is what other companies, newer companies, media companies, content companies, distribution companies, are learning from watching Google and where they'll take the next wave.
Well, one of the things that I know Google worries about in the future is the power of social networks. For instance, if you think about search, when you do a search, I tell the story of,
right,
I typed in a question in the search box, who was the real William Shakespeare? Because there's been a controversy over, mm-hmm, over the centuries whether Shakespeare was a real person or someone else. So how many answers did I get back to that? You know, at the top right-hand corner, they tell you how many responses,
mm-hmm,
they have. 5 million. Now, that's totally useless to me. I don't have time to go through 5 million responses. So a Google search, when you think about it, is often very inefficient. When you get thousands of answers to a simple question, it's inefficient. But then what they're worried about is that social networks, if I'm looking to buy, say, a camera, And instead of doing a Google search about some camera and getting thousands of responses, what if I tweet my friends on Twitter? Or what if I post something to my friends on Facebook? And I get back 15, 20 responses from people I know. Ken, this is a really good camera, and let me tell you why I like it. That's a much more valuable search result than the anonymous search results I get back from Google. And Google worried about that. And one of the reasons why Google made a pitch this past spring to buy Twitter, Twitter was not for sale, was exactly that. They're worried about what's called this form of vertical search.
How much is Google caught up in the idea of what, you know, Andy Grove, the former head of Intel, used to talk about, of only the paranoid surviving? How much time do they spend worrying about these things that we're talking about?
Well, one of the great advantages they have is the two young guys who founded it, who are now 35, Sergey Brin and Larry Page. They are very wary and always on guard about what's coming next. Some of that comes from Larry Page, who as a teenager read a biography of Nikola Tesla, who arguably invented electricity rather than Thomas Edison, but he had a big mouth and was very generous, and he shared all his, quote, secrets with people. And of course Edison took over and Tesla died destitute and bitter, and Larry Page is convinced, and he's helped instill this culture, and Sergey Brin and his partner and friend buys into it, that we have to keep secrets, we have to keep things close to the vest. So if you go to Google and you ask them basic questions, I mean, how many engineers do you have who were born in India, it's like talking to the CIA. They won't share any basic information like that, and in part it's because they're paranoid.
Right.
They're worried about what's going to happen. And the other advantage is that Eric Schmidt, who grew up battling both at Sun and then at Novell, where he was CEO, where he grew up battling Microsoft, he knows that companies like Microsoft could be out to kill you, and you have to be wary. And so it's a wary company. They're always on their toes, worrying about what's next. I mean, I did an interview with Bill Gates in 1998, and I asked him, I said, Mr. Gates, what do you worry about when you think about the future? And I expected him to say he worried about competitors, you know, competitors like Sun Microsystems or Oracle or Netscape. Instead, he said, I'll tell you what I worry about. I worry about someone in a garage who's inventing a new technology I've never thought of that's going to bite Microsoft. Well, in 1998, two guys were in a garage. Their name were Larry Page and Sergey Brin.
Mm-hmm.
And today, Larry Page and Sergey Brin worry, is there a new technology that's going to bite us? And they should.
But, of course, the other thing that they have to worry about is balancing this secrecy with kind of this transparent, do-no-evil image that they have tried to create for the company.
Yeah, no, it's Google is among the most trusted brand names in the world. And in part, that is true because they have earned the trust of their viewers. They don't put ads on their homepage. They don't try and lock you into a Google site. They send you to the search results you want, which are off the Google site. They don't overcharge advertisers. They do a Vickery auction where they charge them only a penny. The first bidder only a penny more than the second bidder, and so on down the line. So there's lots of and they have a slogan: "Don't be evil," which is very appealing. The way Apple's was when Apple went after and still does go after giant Microsoft. But you know, at some point, as you get big, and Google, relatively speaking, is much bigger than Apple in terms of market dominance. Then you arouse traditional American fears about size, and they have to worry about that.
How much do they also need to worry about their own hubris?
Oh, I think you always have to. When you're successful like that, and you have 70% of all the world's searches, and you have almost 50% of all the internet advertising, and you have over 50% of all the videos downloaded on YouTube, which you own. You have to worry about the you should. That is always a danger, that you get too big, too fat, too complacent. People have been doing it for a long time. The founders who work their tail off for so many years suddenly have their two big private jets, and they have both married in the past year. Sergey had a child earlier in the year. Larry's about to become a father for the first time, and they'll start wanting to smell the roses more, and maybe take their eye off the ball. And maybe people have been there a long time as executives get tired and they take their eye off the ball. So, and some of the better younger people leave because they want to go to a startup where they have more power and they feel blocked at Google. So, smugness, hubris is always a danger with a company that grew as fast and as successfully as Google.
We've talked about the paranoia as it relates to new technologies and new, you know, the next great thing coming along. What about how they view the traditional media companies today? How do they look at the Rupert Murdochs and John Malones of the world?
They don't revere them. They don't sit back and with wonder and say they're my idols. If they have an idol, it would be Steve Jobs, not Murdoch or Malone. And they're polite, and they've learned to to be more sociable with them. And I've been at conferences where, like the Allen & Company conference, like the D conference that the Journal puts on, where they mingle with the Murdoch and some of these other media moguls of old. But most of them they wouldn't recognize if they passed them on the street. And they live in their own world out there in Silicon Valley. And they're engineers, and they take some pride in that. And they tend to view a lot of what happens in traditional media as wasteful.
Ken Auletta, the book is Googled, The End of the World as We Know It. He's going to be over at Book Passage next Tuesday, the 10th. Ken, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.